Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Welcome back, you guys. Next on the podcast, we have Dr. Mike T. Nelson, who I actually met at a conference that I was presenting at. And I was blown away not only at the level of knowledge this man has, oh my goodness, but also just his humbleness and his open to answer any questions that I had. And he's actually a research fanatic who specializes in metabolic flexibility and heart rate variability, as well as an online trainer. And he's a professor or faculty member. And he's also a creator of the Flex Diet certification, which we're going to go into. What is a Flex Diet? What does that mean? And answer just so many nutrition questions that you have. And he breaks it down in such a simple and easy to digest way so that you can really start to take action on this now. The techniques he's developed and the results Mike gets for his clients have been featured in international magazines, in scientific publications, and on websites across the globe. He's truly doing the research. He's really creating the results, working from clients from high-level athletes to your everyday person. And he truly just so smart. So I'm excited for this interview and I can't wait to dive in with him. All right. I'm so excited for this podcast, Dr. Mike, because you are just so knowledgeable. I know I said that when you first came on too, but it's something that I've been extremely impressed with from the moment I met you and how you presented your information and your education, because I feel like you come from a very humble place as well. So I'm excited for people to just be able to really learn from you in this podcast. So first of all, just thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on here. Really appreciate it. And always good to chat with you again.
Yeah. Do you mind just letting people know like a general background of what you do?
Yeah. So right now I do a couple different things. I'm an associate professor at the Carrig Institute. They primarily do more clinical neuroscience, or what kind of used to be called functional neurology. And with them, I do courses more on the exercise performance side. So I helped with their human performance course, more on the nutrition part module of that. And I did a course on just updating clinicians on neurology research. And then I literally just finished recording right before this one on the ketogenic diet as a potential use for traumatic brain injury. So that one will be hopefully out in a little while. And then I'm an instructor for Rocky Mountain University. I work with clients online, one-on-one. Been doing that for quite a while. And then I created the Flex Diet certification and then also just finished the Physiologic Flexibility certification. So keeps me busy.
That's incredible. And I think the thing I respect the most, especially when I hear about people's journey and what you've done, I respect how you are now teaching people through certifications and other things who then teach people. And you're, especially since you're so diligent about how you get your information and you're on the front lines doing the research and figuring out how it's applied to different populations, you're just helping get good quality information to the rest of the world. And something we'd like to ask people early on in our interviews is just what initially kind of drove you to do that? What's your driver, your why you want to get this information out into the world?
I've been pretty fortunate to do kind of a wide variety of backgrounds. I did a Bachelor of Arts in Natural Science and then actually went into engineering. So I did a master's in mechanical engineering. And I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll work in, you know, biomedical engineering for a while, which I did in a cardiac med tech company for about 12 years. And while I was doing that, I'm like, well, I like physiology. I just started taking physiology classes for fun. I even took an exercise physiology class for fun, which I was so excited about. Professor's like, why do you want to take a 400 level exercise physiology class? Because it's so cool. That's
yeah,
why. Because
it's awesome.
And so I worked in the med tech industry for a while. I did a short stint doing a PhD in biomedical engineering and then went back and did a PhD in exercise physiology, more on the metabolism side. And along the way, I think I just enjoyed the teaching process and getting, I guess, better information out to people. Because as you guys know, there's no shortage of, I'd say, low quality information to to put it nicely. And, you know, fast forward now, it's nice to be in positions of, you know, teaching other people, you know, trainers and other educators, because to me, that's more leverage. So if you're looking at the end of the day, you only have so much time to do so many things. And if I can then educate people, like you said, who are then educating others, that makes me feel a little bit better because your information is going farther and hopefully you can have a bigger impact then at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's huge. And I just appreciate, you know, the way that you're able to present the information. Now, when we're talking, you know, diets, you came up with something called the Flex Diet. Now, why did you even choose to put the name diet to it? And what does the Flex Diet kind of encompass?
Yeah. So the little backstory is that I didn't want the word diet in there at all. So I had done stuff. My research was in metabolic flexibility. So how well does your body use carbohydrates? How well does your body use fat? And how well does it switch back and forth? So I had done some early e-classes. I had used it with my clients, obviously published research in that area. And it was about 3 years ago that I did some continuing education products for trainers. And it, you know, it was okay. It didn't really go anything too crazy. And I actually met with Ryan Lee, and he's like, oh, I got the perfect name for you. He's like, you should call it Flex Diet. I was like, on one hand, I'm like, oh, that's actually a really good title. And then on the other hand, immediately I'm like, has the word diet in it. I hate the word diet. But then I realized that that was probably more or less just my interpretation of the word diet. Where if you go to general population, you mention the word diet, most people kind of know what you're talking about. So I opted to go forward with it under that title and then created a certification around it to try to get your arms around. There's, you know, tons of different things you could be doing in relation to nutrition and recovery. But the biggest problem I saw, especially for educational trainers or just general population, was getting good information, you know, information that actually is going to work. And it was based on research. And then where do you start? You know, so I came up with a way of ranking the different interventions. So initially, I was just going to rank them all based on, you know, obviously my background, that's a physiologic impact, right? This thing has a bigger physiologic impact than this other thing. So obviously, you're going to start with the thing that has a more bigger physiologic impact. But then I soon realized when I thought about it that, oh, that doesn't always work in reality, right? So I could argue, and I have in the past argued with lots of clients about sleep. Oh, you need to get more than 6 hours of sleep a night. And oh, it was, I'd rather pound my head into a wall than talk to clients about getting sleep. Because they all would agree that, yeah, I should, but, you know, finding ways to make it practical was super hard. However, like protein, once I got over the fact that, wait a minute, I'm doing this diet thing and you're telling me to eat more of a specific food. That seems crazy. I'm like, but yeah, isn't that kind of the goal? Like, isn't that what you like, you know, subconsciously want to do is eat more on a diet? So once I figured that out, like getting them to eat more protein was relatively easy. So even though protein and sleep both have a big physiologic impact, from the psychology or the client's ability to actually do the thing that you as a trainer would be recommending, there was a huge difference. So getting people to do the action item of eating more protein, relatively easy. Getting them to do the intervention of more sleep, pretty darn hard. So I said, well, then your coaching leverage, as I called it, was just the physiologic impact times the psychology impact or the client's ability to change. So protein, very high on both. So your composite score, pretty high. Sleep, very high on physiology, maybe like a 9 or 10 out of a 1 to 10. Like ability for most people to do it, like pretty horrible, like a 1.
Yeah.
So their composite score then is a 10. So when I ranked all of them, protein ended up coming out number 1, and sleep ended up coming out the last one, number 8. So that way, when people start, you would start with the thing that has the biggest impact in terms of both physiology and psychology. So we would start with different aspects of protein more so than sleep.
I think that's super important. I'm just talking about the realism in applying these different things to our lives. And I love how you kind of address it, of course, as this super multifactorial thing, but that affects the physiology. And that's really what we're looking for, is to address the physiology. And there's a lot of means to get there. And people act like there's something special about their method, right? But really, a lot of us are just addressing a certain underlying physiologic principle. And one that you specifically mentioned that I have a ton of interest in is metabolic flexibility, because I think that's one physiologic thing that a lot of diets, quote, will help address, whether it be the keto or the intermittent fasting, fasting in general, caloric restriction. You know, they're all just tapping in on some of these certain physiologic principles. So can you talk a little bit more into what metabolic flexibility means, why it's important, different ways that people can start to explore that?
Sure. So as I say, the metabolic flexibility is how well your body can use both carbohydrates and fats. And in the sort of diet world, use the word diet again, everyone wants to sort of demonize one thing or the else. Like, we've gone through, you know, the high carb phase, we've gone through the low fat phase, now we're in kind of a keto fasting type phase. And they all have, you know, different populations and different things where they can be beneficial. But it seems like everyone wants to focus on either one macronutrient or the other.
Yeah.
It's either carbohydrates are good. No, they're bad. You know, fat's good. Nope, fat's bad. You know, now protein is this kind of sort of demonized. Ooh, we don't want too much mTOR and all this other stuff. It's bad for longevity, which it's not. So it seems like the trend is to sort of demonize one of the macronutrients or the other. But with metabolic flexibility, you want to be able to use both. So if we're just kind of hanging out, like having this conversation, or we want to go do some low intensity exercise, it's to our advantage to use fat as a fuel source. And we don't need to create a whole bunch of energy real fast. We're not doing anything that's speed, power. We're not doing anything that's super intense. And, you know, even lean athletes have a fair amount of fat that they can use for fuel. Or if you had a meal that's higher in fat, you would use that. On the other end of the spectrum, even for general population, we want to make sure that when they go to do exercise, if we put them on an extremely low carbohydrate diet, and had them do some higher intensity exercise, you know, intervals, or even Metcons, weight training, it can feel harder if their body is trying to use carbohydrates to do that exercise, but maybe they're on an extremely low carbohydrate diet. In that case, if for athletes, if their speed and power is what their sport is based on, carbohydrates are going to be a better fuel for that. So metabolic flexibility is we want to use the right fuel at the right time. And if we take something that's popular like fasting, I think fasting is a good intervention. I did the flex diet. I actually ended up having fasting as the second one because it accomplishes a couple things. When we do a longer fast, let's say we work up to one day of a 19 to 24 hour fast, our insulin levels are going to be relatively low or lower. And that's going to push us to use more fat as a fuel source. Mm. So fasting has the capacity of increasing our metabolic flexibility to use fats better. It also has a benefit of just, you know, cutting out a full day's worth of calories. And in practice, if people take time and kind of work up to a longer fast, I find that most people can do it relatively easy. With a few exceptions, if people are super, you know, high stress or other exceptions, but the vast majority of people can actually do it. So when I looked at metabolic flexibility, to me, that was kind of the base physiology of where we want to get to, because that's more of a state of health. If we become metabolically inflexible, we know that that's moving towards more of a disease state, especially like type 2 diabetics. They have a very hard time initially using carbohydrates, right? So when you say diabetics, most people, especially type 2, you're thinking of more of a carbohydrate-centric disease. But what people forget is that over time, as their body does start losing the ability to use carbs really well. It puts out more insulin acutely to try to solve the problem, in addition to a bunch of other hormonal changes. As insulin goes up and up, it does push the body eventually to start using more carbohydrates. But because insulin now is higher, we actually start losing the ability to downshift and to use fat effectively. So for a type 2 diabetic, as the disease progresses, we're losing carbohydrate metabolism kind of on the right end of the spectrum. And as the disease progresses, we're actually starting to lose fat metabolism on the other side of the spectrum. So we're getting kind of crunched from both sides as the disease progresses. So when you view things through the lens of metabolic flexibility, you can do things that will help body composition, potentially can help performance, and then you can also do it through a lens of actually increasing your health and not having it degrade in the process.
That is so important for, I think, people to just continue to kind of wrap their heads around how it all works and how food is fuel. I think if we can continue to push that message as what fuels you based on what you do on your day to day, it becomes more about what works for your body, what is needed for you in your life, and less about what do I need to take out? What do I need to restrict? But it's, you know, more of that message of what can I add in that fuels my body? And so I love that that's how you're even approaching it without even saying that. That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm interpreting from what you're, for kind of how you present it. And I really like that.
Yeah. I mean, even when I did the Flex Diet Survey, which obviously I'm biased because I created it, I wanted something that is telling people, here's what you should do, right? Because I made this mistake super early on years ago. I had a client, he was a male, he was like 40 pounds overweight. Did his dietary recall. I look at the foods he's eating. He's eating like a sleeve of Oreos every day. Mm. I'm like, oh, this nutrition stuff, so easy, right? Hey, stop eating Oreos. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense, right? Oreos, a lot of processed food, extra calories. I don't need them. Got it. Comes back next week. He's still eating a whole sleeve of Oreos every day. I'm like, hey, what's going on? And so this goes on for 6 or 7 weeks because I'm not very bright at times. And eventually I kind of got frustrated and just said, just don't worry about any of this nutrition stuff. Let's just go, let's just train in the gym. Hmm. And I realized that this whole time I'm berating this poor guy about his Oreos, like all he's consciously and subconsciously thinking about is Oreos. Right? It's like, don't think of a pink elephant. It's like, oh shit, I just thought of a pink elephant. Mm-hmm. Like, but I told you, don't think of the pink elephant, right? So consciously, you know, subconsciously, he's just thinking Oreos all the time. Eventually, when I figured that out, I'm like, okay, so now what I want you to do is, I don't care how many Oreos you eat. Doesn't matter. He kind of looks at me, is like, what? I'm like, but you have to eat 40 grams of protein first. And here's what it looks like, you know, 6-7 ounces of chicken breast. We go through the whole education component. He's like, after that, you can eat as many Oreos as you want. It's like, really? I'm like, yep. And it turns out he started eating less Oreos. It's like, oh, great. Right? Because now I'm telling him, hey, let's eat more protein first. And then, hey, let's have some, you know, non-starchy vegetables first. Let's have a little bit more fiber. Hey, let's drink some more water. Hey, let's go for a walk in the morning, right? So I realized that by giving people what you want them to do, and that'll kind of push out some of the other stuff, you know, which goes against kind of what all the popular diet books are of just, you know, here's your naughty and nice list of foods. Mm-hmm. And if you just follow that, you'll be fine. Yeah. People can do that. I mean, that can definitely work, but I don't think that's the best approach for a long-term success.
Yeah. And I think that that's what we try to get at with movement, is that there's no one way. You know, the one way generally has to do with consistency and trying different things and figuring out what your body reacts the best and reacts most to. And I love how you just kind of addressed there working with a client and how the behavior change aspect is usually the biggest part and the most difficult part. We can talk about keto or fasting or whatever all we want, but if we can't get somebody to stop eating the sleeve of Oreos, let's focus on a different issue. Let's focus on something else, because there's clearly something, a better way to approach that. We were talking a bit about how, you know, initially, or I think it was, a lot of the information you would put out would be geared towards the man, or the male specifically lifting in the weight room.
Yeah.
But now you're doing a lot more work with women and with female clients. And can you speak a little towards the difference in how you need to you know, coach or educate them on things like fasting and keto diet. I know specifically for women, they talk a lot about those and where the woman's at in her menstrual cycle or where she's at in that throughout life. Can you speak a little to that?
Yeah, so it's kind of odd. Like, you know, most of my content goes out through my newsletter, which you can get on at just flexdiet.com. Just go to the wait list, it'll put you on there. Most of my writing is kind of geared towards the, I call it the stereotypical, you know, dude bro in his, you know, mid-20s to early 30s, maybe early 40s. And paradoxically, for many years, I've been doing online coaching. My online clients are 70 to 80% female and like have been the whole time, which I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. So maybe the females I work with are kind of a biased sort of population. And I've asked them a lot of times, I said, well, why is that? And they're like, well, because you don't sound like you're talking to women all the time. Mm. I was like, oh, I think that's a good thing. And what I realized was, I think they're trying to say is that if you're focused on most of the big principles based on physiology, it's going to work for mostly males and females. And of course, there's going to be differences between females and males. But what I've noticed over the years is, I don't know how much of that is based on physiology or just, you know, some of the roles that they have. So, for example, I do a lot of heart rate variability analysis, which is a way of determining stress levels on people. And I find that, you know, women have a harder time taking more time for themselves and doing more kind of recovery aspects, you know, just whether that's breath work or meditation or, you know, sometimes even doing a yoga class or going to bed early. And maybe that's because they have more other responsibilities that they feel like they're in charge of. Now, I could look at that and say that, oh, women tend to be more stressed than men. But is that a physiologic thing, or is it just that they tend to do more other roles because they feel like they're responsible for things around the house? And now, especially with COVID, the education of the kids and making sure they do their online schooling and everything else. So I find with women, it's harder for them to get them to take more time for themselves. For training, I find that women probably don't lift quite heavy enough. Guys are probably the opposite. I usually need to tell them to stop doing as many stupid things. So I definitely think there are differences in terms of ketogenic diets and in terms of different things related to menstrual cycle. I don't know. I mean, I tried some of that in all honesty a couple of years ago, and it was kind of a disaster, to be perfectly honest. It was just, I don't know how much of a physiologic change it had for how much time I was spending trying to track it and talk to clients about. Maybe it matters. I don't know. I just haven't found any clients that are that dialed in enough that it would make a difference. Now, I think you can have people who will definitely self-report that it made a huge difference. Now, is that because everything lined up with certain parts of their cycle, or they just did things that were better?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's probably the latter. And I definitely do agree that there is no doubt a lack of research comparing gender differences for males versus females. A vast majority of the studies that have been done are on males because it's easier to study. If you're going to peer review, you don't have to worry about some of the hormonal stuff, trying to get them around the same menstrual cycle and different other things that you may have to look at. And in the studies I did, we used both males and females. I was mainly looking at caffeine, energy drinks, things of that nature. So we had pretty good documentation that there's not really a gender difference that we know of so far for caffeine intake and effects. So I didn't really have to worry about it in that case. So I definitely think we need more research in that area. NIH does have a pretty big initiative over the last couple of years to get more female subjects into studies of all kind, which I think will be super useful. But at this point, at least on the preliminary data I've seen so far, I don't know if it makes a huge physiologic difference, although I definitely agree that there are differences in how you would interact with that population. Mm-hmm. And I can say from in-person training, I would train females all day over most guys, in all honesty, because maybe it's just my experience that I've had with in-person training, but females are just way easier to train. Like they listen, they like do the stuff you want them to do. In terms of a population, I actually generally prefer it, but that's again just my bias.
I'm only nodding my head in agreement. That's all I'll say.
I may have offended a whole bunch of people now, but
no, but that's so funny. And it's so interesting too, because me as a physical therapist, I have found the same that you were kind of saying, how women don't usually take the time to, or aren't finding it accessible in their life to really take those recovery time. It's like, yeah, I have this pain, I need to get rid of it. Tell me the quick things. Cause, and it's like this stress level is still so high. Right. And so it's so interesting that you find that as well in terms of how you're kind of approaching it. And so what are ways that we can kind of simplify it? And I know this is going to be obviously an oversimplification, but what are ways that people can at least, especially women, just start? Like, what are some basic principles that you really recommend in terms of diet and fueling yourself that people can kind of take these principles and start with?
Yeah, a big one is I'm a big fan of protein. Usually trying to get women to eat a little bit more protein, I found now was quite a bit easier than it was, you know, 10 years ago. So I find it's not too hard to do that now, although I would say many years ago was quite a bit harder. Yeah, and I don't know if that was because many years ago, women were more afraid of, you know, adding too much muscle, and protein was more of a male-centric food. I don't know. But I think starting with more protein, you know, for all people is going to be beneficial. And then the question is, well, how much protein? You can go the very simplified route. So about 4 meals for women, about 30 grams. Guys, 4 meals at around 40 grams. And the reason for the difference there is that it's just done by body weight. So women still tend to be smaller than guys. If you want to do math, you're looking at, based on the research in US units, about 0.7 grams per pound of body weight. So if you weigh 200 pounds, 200 times 0.7, you're looking at a total amount of 140 grams of protein per day. Now, it's definitely a lot higher than the RDA. RDA averages about 60 grams per day, but it's not super crazy, right? You get into some bodybuilding type circles and it's like, yeah, 1 to 2 grams a day. I'm like, 2 grams a day, like a 200-pound person, that's 400 grams of protein. That's crazy, you know? So it's higher, but not excessively high. You know, if you translate that into, you know, real food, what are you looking at? Yeah, if you're eating some type of meat or fish, it's, you know, 4 to 6 ounces there 4 times a day. You know, it's higher, but it, again, it's definitely doable. It's not super crazy. Some people, if they're not used to that, will usually report that they feel a lot more full and they don't have as much appetite for other things, which that sounds like a win to me. So that's a big one. I do like using fasting for a lot of people, as long as they take a gradual approach to it. And again, I would not use fasting if someone is super stressed out and they tend to chronically undereat. So one of the questions I'll ask them is like, hey, when you get like super stressed, do you tend to eat more or do you tend to just not eat at all? And if they're like, no, I don't really eat at all. And I look at their dietary recall and they're like, you know, trying to live on like 1,000 calories a day. Yeah, fasting probably not going to be the best approach for you. Your self-report or your HRV scores are just crazy. You're super stressed. And probably not going to be the best approach. But outside of that, I find that slowly working up to one longer fast once a week of 19 to 24 hours is pretty good. So for a lot of people, that's, you know, Monday may be their fasting day. They had dinner at, let's say, 8 p.m. on Sunday. So breakfast at 8 a.m. Yeah, they already did a 12-hour fast. Cool. So let's do the following Monday. Let's see if you can do 14 hours, right? So just push breakfast to 10 a.m. Yeah, you did 14 hours. Okay, following week. Some people, for whatever reason, still love their breakfast. So eat breakfast at lunch, right? So have your breakfast at noon. Oh, great. You added another 2 hours. Now, within like, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, they can usually do a 19 to 24 hour fast once a week, like pretty easily. So that's definitely beneficial. And after that, you can, you know, get into, you know, carbohydrate amount, I find will vary a lot from one person to the next. a lot of that depends upon what are they doing for exercise, kind of how active they are. Again, even for general population, I'm a big fan of them monitoring their exercise performance. And that doesn't have to be anything crazy. Just, you know, hey, I did a bench press with 40 pound dumbbells for 8 reps. Oh, in a couple of weeks, I got 9 reps and then 10 reps. Great. You're doing better. Right. And you can just keep that in track in an old school notebook if you want. And it doesn't need to be, you know, super tracky, heavy. You don't need to log everything in a phone app or, you know, something like that. So things like that, I think those are probably some of the top easy things people can do. Because especially now I see people almost cutting their carbohydrates a little bit too aggressively and their performance in the gym is going down. And then their motivation to train kind of goes with that, right? No one really wants to go to the gym and train if it feels like it's always really hard and you don't really ever seem to be making any progress, right? You know, that's not going to be a good recipe for you to want to stay with it long term.
I think those are really like amazing ways for people to start. I think that was so educational for people, and hopefully they really take that and start to see, okay, what am I doing? How am I fueling my body? And one thing I just wanted to say too, my mom, she's actually in her upper 60s. And one of the things that she recently told me was how much fasting has just helped her to maintain. She doesn't have to work. I mean, she is a healthy person. She walks like crazy every single day and does exercise and eats pretty well, but she doesn't really have to focus as much on her food or her weight because she said, when I fast, it just maintains itself and it's so easy.
And I think that reconceptualizing what a fast means, I read on one of your things that it said a fast is any period of time without food. And so that's what a fast is, kind of like a diet is anybody's, you know, food that they intake. That's what the diet is. Okay, how do we change that? The fast is any period without food. And then it's around 14, 16 hours that we start to gain good benefit. And then we can talk about, as we go into that fast, what starts to happen. So I love that, just incorporating that understanding of what fasting is, how it helps us access the different carbohydrate or fat burning systems. And then the first one was just focused on protein. And like you said, I think if we just track anything, even if it's in a notebook, like, oh, I think I ate about 100 grams of protein today, and we start becoming aware of that, then we just start to become more aware of our choices and we choose the more nutrient dense things that also come with all the other amazing nutrients. And when we talk about protein, I think a big thing that comes in is supplements. And Should we be supplementing? When are supplements valuable? I mean, can you talk a little bit into supplements and some things you might recommend for the average person today?
Yeah, I think some supplements can be useful. I think a lot of them are probably overblown in terms of the percentage of effectiveness. You know, supplements from a sports performance realm, because that's very easy to monitor. Hey, you did more work or you ran faster, right? Those are things in the lab that are very easy to see an outcome. In terms of sport performance, you're still talking like the most efficacious supplements are like single digit percentages for things like, you know, creatine, caffeine, things that have been very well studied. It's not like a 50% effect, right? Those are the top ones, and you're still talking about single digits, which if you're an elite athlete, that can make a massive difference. If you're more general population, not as much. So for general population, I'm a bigger fan of supplements that just kind of look like they were real food at one point. You know, if you have a harder time getting in enough protein, I think you make an easy argument for adding protein as a supplement. I think that's fine. Fish oil is a supplement, a good one. Yes, in a perfect world, if we could all eat, you know, fresh caught, you know, wild cold water fish that's really clean without mercury and other pollutants in it, that'd be amazing. But it's probably not most people's life, and fish oil now is very clean as a supplement and pretty darn inexpensive. I'm a big fan of a multivitamin, multinutrient blend. I think it's cheap insurance. I don't think it's going to make up for a really horrible diet if that's your diet. But I think to shore up some, you know, missing micronutrients, especially if you're pretty high stressed, there's some very interesting studies on that from Julia Ruckledge and some others where they would look at doing intervention after a natural disaster, where obviously a population is going to be very stressed, but they were all exposed to the same stressor. So it gave them a way to look at, one group got a multi-nutrient blend, one got a placebo, and the groups that got more micronutrients, you know, did better in response to the stress, especially now with the amount of stress people are under. So I think that can be beneficial. Outside of that, you know, I mean, I used to be more of a fan of vitamin D. I think there's still a lot of beneficial data on it. But now I try to also look to see, instead of just giving them vitamin D, it's like, well, why are you low in vitamin D? Mm-hmm. It's like, I can understand, you know, we're working on the protein, getting you to eat more protein. Maybe fish isn't an option, or you don't like it, that type of thing. It's an economic thing. I got it. But sunlight in most places is pretty free. And usually if your vitamin D is super low, that's telling me you're probably not outside a whole lot. So then I start looking at, you know, can you be outside a little bit more? Maybe you're like me, you live in a weird environment of Minnesota, and we did your, you know, blood draw in like January, so it may be a little bit low. But starting to look at other factors that are related to that. And if they're not able to do that, I think using vitamin D as a supplement can be beneficial. But those would be kind of the basic ones. If you want to get fancy, maybe throw some magnesium in there in the evening, or a few other things. But you know, basic stuff like that, I think, is you can get a lot of beneficial long-term health effects from it. Again, you know, you're not going to see, you know, start losing weight miraculously. And most of your kind of fat loss type supplements are dramatically overrated, to say the least.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good, easy breakdown for people to kind of follow. And I think it's important for people to realize, like, what are you just intaking for your food? Yeah. You know, before we start worrying about all these supplements, what are you doing for your food and for your movement and getting outside? And it was funny because we just got a place in Minnesota and we're going to be back there in February. And oh, I nice. Joked that I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to go outside like all of the whole month.
And I keep saying, okay, you're really going to get a flavor of Minnesota seasonal depression like you've never had before, because I still like to get outside because the sun's still shining, even if it's minus 30.
Yeah. I mean, that is the nice part about, I mean, I've spent my whole life growing up in Minnesota, and we usually travel a fair amount up until this year. But I mean, a lot of other places I've been, it's cold, it's dreary, it's kind of horrible looking. Like Minnesota, like you said, it can be 15 below, but it's relatively sunny in the winter. And to me, it just doesn't feel as bad then. I mean, I could run around buck naked all winter and not really get much vitamin D, but it doesn't feel as bad.
Well, I'll give it a shot a couple times, okay?
Yeah.
But I did want to know, like, do you have recommendations in terms of brands for some of these supplements that you brought up?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's pretty good brands. Most fish oil supplements now that have been tested are actually pretty good. You can get pretty high dose fish oil supplements now that are relatively clean. So any one of those are probably going to be okay. Having said that, I do spend a little bit more money on something that is going to be a structural component of my body, whether that ends up being like, you know, collagen for specific cases or fish oil. I use some stuff through Driven Sports Nutrition. I know the CEO there. But fish oil generally is pretty good, pretty clean. For a multi-nutrient blend, I use stuff from Thorn. I use their AM or PM is pretty good. I use another one from Hardy Nutritionals. They have some actual finished clinical research on their products, even for different pathologies, ADHD and some other cases. So it's nice to see that they actually have clinical studies on the finished product. In addition to, you can get super geeky and look at all the different types of forms that are in there. Kind of a cheap test to do is look at a multivitamin and look to see what form of magnesium that they use. Mm-hmm. If they're using like magnesium oxide, which probably only gets converted at like 2-4%, it's not a guarantee, but it's something that maybe not be the best formulation overall. Again, is that a perfect test? No. But if they're not going to spend at least a little bit more money to buy a better form and something that we know is well documented to not really convert that much, I don't know if I trust the rest of the formulation. Those are probably like some of the top ones. Vitamin D, D3 is the only one you're going to be able to get as a supplement now. Most of those are generally going to be pretty good. They're pretty inexpensive. D2 is going to be still prescription based, which oddly probably isn't better.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I love, I'm always looking for that next little trick on how to read the label and figure out if it's a good or a bad product. So checking out what form of magnesium, that's a good thing to be checking on.
And call the company, like ask them questions. Yeah. You know, it's like if the company won't even take your questions, to me, it's like I don't even want to do business with them. You know, and you can then go down and ask them, you know, how do we know what is actually in the product? You know, you can ask for things like what's called a COA. Mm-hmm. There's different things you can do to try to eval companies. But, you know, the companies who are doing it the correct way will be more than happy to help you and provide whatever documentation that's reasonable to demonstrate that they are doing it in a better way. Because it's freaking expensive to do it that way. It's way cheaper to, unfortunately, you know, put out something acutely that's not as high of a quality, which sadly, there's still some of those companies around.
Oh, yeah. We know some people who do that almost like for their podcast and call companies, email companies, ask for their COAs, and then just put out like, hey, they're not being transparent. That tells me that they either don't have them, don't trust them, don't like what's on them. So I wouldn't trust this company. And it's, you know, simple as that. The people that you said are doing it right, they're going to be transparent. They're going to try and get the information out there and be honest about what they're putting out there. So you can trust the products they put out. With all the stuff you've told us tonight, thank you so much for being on. Dr. Mike, where can people find more about all the stuff you put out?
Yeah, best place for just kind of the hub of everything and general information is going to be miketnelson.com. So miketnelson.com. There's usually a little banner or something there on the top where you can get onto the newsletter for free. Most of the content I have goes out over the newsletter. And then if you're interested, I have a podcast too, which is the Flex Diet Podcast. You can find any podcast player that you use. And if you sign up to the newsletter, just send me a note through there and you heard me on this podcast and I'll send you a free gift.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Dr. Mike. I know I have subscribed to your podcast as well because just learning from people who are so knowledgeable is it helps me become a well-rounded person and clinician as well. So I appreciate the information that you put out and probably going to get on the newsletter as well because, again, you are a person that I think people get to learn from. And thank you for just all that you do. I truly, truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you both for having me on here and all the kind words. I really appreciate it. And let me know when you're back in Minnesota.
I will.
Absolutely. And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.